this afternoon's session is the Child Survival Revolution. And we're Peter and Ricky Thompson from Minneapolis. And a real tremendous summary of this is in this little booklet here. And we've been talking this week about some of the root causes of hunger and some of the things people can do and some of the issues and a lot of kind of controversial things about hunger. And I think today will be really a lot more hopeful and positive, because we are going to talk about some of the things, and in particular this particular thing that's going on, what you can do to help keep the momentum for the Child Survival Revolution, what it is, what good it's doing now, what good it can be doing in the future, and then some other things about what we can do. Just to go backwards a little bit, we have been doing sessions on ending hunger. And I think, has everyone here been to a session?
Anybody new?
Yeah, I think everyone has been to at least one session. So we really don't need to repeat a lot. As you know, that our whole presentation is to really empower people to be able to do something about it in their own lives, rather than to be paralyzed by the problem and to operate out of impotence and guilt and really not being able to do anything. And so, thanks for coming back.
If you know, have any questions, like since we're just a small group this afternoon, like from previous sessions, I think we should just let this be real loose and address any special concerns that you have about things that you have done, would like to do. You know, if there's any way that we can, you know, help you or help each other, let's do that today, because this would be a good opportunity to do that.
And since you've already been here, you've noticed probably in two or three of our sessions, we only got about halfway through our agenda. So if there were some burning issues or some information that, you know, you really wanted to get to that we didn't get to, you know, we can clean up some of those or go back to some of those too, after we go through some of the information on the Child Survival Revolution. Anyone know what it is? Or have you heard of it? In one of our, oh, you were just finishing your stitch.
Yeah.
I thought you were raising your hand. In one of our sessions, we were talking about Bread for the World. Bread for the World is a Christian group that I think a lot of Lutheran churches are involved in. In fact, they have a program whereby you can become a covenant Bread for the World church if the church votes to actually do that. And that's something you can look at in your own congregation. But they did a lot of lobbying on the child survival legislation that was in Congress, and one of the women here that was a member for Bread for the World said that after it passed and the United States appropriated some money for it, they did some computations, and every letter that was sent in to a congressman netted on an average $500 in an appropriation. And $500 in terms of immunizing children around the world goes a tremendously long way. What the Child Survival Revolution is, an overview, and we have a real nice video that talks about it, and in particular one of the facets of it. If you look at this little handout we have here, look on the second page where they have the four different numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4. A shorthand for the Child Survival Revolution is GOBI, the acronym G-O-B-I. And it's really the four steps that they are concentrating on in looking at health for children. Number one, the G is for growth monitoring. And what the growth monitoring is that oftentimes children in developing countries are not growing adequately because of malnutrition or undernutrition. And unless there is some kind of monitoring going on of the child, the mother doesn't even notice. And so the child can become severely malnourished and not growing properly without noticing. So First thing is growth monitoring. It's usually done just by a simple system of scales that's low cost, and they bring their children into the weighing center periodically to make sure that the child is growing, and then the only investment for the group putting it on, once they have the scale, are little cards, and a card costs a dime per kid, and they keep the card and they take it home or they leave it at the center, and they just monitor the child's height and weight. It's like it would be very natural here when you go to the pediatrician, but it's a real breakthrough in the third world countries because they don't have that sort of thing. So they keep track, and as soon as there's a dip in the child, then they're warned that they have to do something, that there's a problem, and they can attend to it.
Oral rehydration, I think, will be addressed in the film, so I don't think we need to go into that in detail. Should I mention a little scoop around?
Sure.
Okay. Oral rehydration is just 10,000 kids die of diarrhea, dehydration. Well, 7 million, there's 7 million a year who could be saved. No, that's the organization again.
10,000
a day die of that. You know, I saw that written there. I thought that can't be. That's too high. 10,000 children die every day from dehydration, from diarrhea, and it's something that can be stopped real simply through a solution of sugar, salt, and water. And it has to be in just the exact balance because it affects the electrolyte system in your body, but it goes into effect almost immediately. The film will go into details on that. When we were in Sri Lanka, before we left for Sri Lanka, we tried to get, it's called an ORT package, oral rehydration therapy package here. We looked all over. Finally, we got one at the drugstore, which sold for about, you know, $4 for their sugar and salt in a package, but we didn't know the right proportion, and it has to be just exact. But in some of the developing countries, what they have is a little scooper like this, and it just tells you, we'll pass it around. You put the sugar level here, salt level here, and then they explain, I think it's about a 6-ounce cup. You mix it around, and you drink it after each diarrhea, and the results you'll see are just spectacular. One question that's sometimes raised that I would like to mention now that kind of applies to all of these and that came up for me was, well, so we save all these kids, you know, that are near death. You know, are they, you know, going to be mentally retarded? Are they going to be any benefit to society at all? And we have been told that even the effects of mental retardation, like up to 2 years of, you know, malnourishment, and the effects of malnourishment can be reversed. So that, for me anyway, was very helpful because I always wondered if we'd just be left with a generation of vegetables, you know, from saving kids.
And look at, after you look at that spoon too, look on the back. It's a real, this is what kind of appropriate medical technology is like. One of the biggest problems in trying to give our medical technology to the third world is it's unusable because it gets too complicated. Well, here you have this nice little spoon, and would you just read what it says on the back? It's kind of like a little warning thing so they know how to use it properly.
It says, taste, do not use it more salty than it tears.
And see, there's a universal thing. I mean, the important thing is to have people to be able to handle things themselves and to do it themselves. And if you had some kind of percentage or fancy saline solution language back there, no one would know what to do. And the other anecdote, when we were leaving, we really wanted some ORT for traveling. We were going to be in India and Sri Lanka, and you know, your chance of getting diarrhea is real high. And this is a wonderful thing because you can just give it yourself. You don't need to take any powerful chemicals like Lomotil and that sort of thing. And it really works because it makes water like 10,000 times more absorbable into the system because it's the proper electrolyte balance. It's just an incredible breakthrough. And people have known about it for a long time. But in Minneapolis, I tried to find some, and I called doctors, and I called clinics, and I called hospitals, and they finally said, oh, there's a doctor over in St. Paul with the international division of so-and-so, and I called him, and his nurse says, no, you'll have to have a prescription, and it went on and on and on. And we finally found some packets that were something like it. They were real expensive. They were packaged up in, you know, foil and all this kind of mess.
Came with a plastic cup, of course.
We get over there to Sri Lanka and we're visiting some of our sponsored children who lived in the slums over there through Save the Children. We had three little girls that our family sponsors. And the woman who was taking us around, they just had a spoon right there, you know. And we said, what's that? And they said, oh, it's the ORT spoon. And it's just there and available. And no one in this country, no one needs it because, you know, prescriptions and, you know, we'll spend all the money to do all that sort of thing. I just have a couple anecdotes that aren't on this video about Egypt. 3 years ago, diarrhea was Egypt's leading killer of young children. It would kill 130,000 kids under two annually. Now, they had a big program over there to make people aware. One of the big things of something like this is to make the people aware and so they can really use it. Over 75% of the Egyptian mothers now use the oral rehydration salts. And the British Medical Journal has called it the world's most successful health program. The reason it's been successful is, number one, they've used packaging that's very simple, similar to this. You know, that is, it can be used just in a cup. It doesn't have to be used in some fancy form. The form we finally got to go was for gallons. Well, you know, if you just want a cup, you don't want to have to make a gallon, because then what are you going to do with the rest of the gallon to haul it around and all that sort of thing? The other thing it did is it trained mothers not only to use it, but to keep using it every time there is diarrhea. In other words, it's not so many times a day or something fancy like that. It's just every time the person has diarrhea, after they have the diarrhea, they take it to rehydrate the body, to get, you know, liquid back into the body. They did television spots. They had popular actresses do the spots. They had billboards. And so people, radio, newspapers, really learned about it. And now it's sold in pharmacies. It's distributed free through government clinics. And Egypt, in addition to this has been so successful, they've now committed that by the end of this summer, they will have had all of the children in Egypt immunized, which will make another huge difference. And that's the fourth of these, of the four that's mentioned, is immunization.
Should we please?
Sure.
The third one, the B, is for breastfeeding. And I think you're probably all pretty much aware of all the stuff that went on with Nestle's and the arguments against infant formula and the, you know, the water is bad and that mothers should breastfeed their babies. In developing countries especially, probably all countries. So that's what, I don't think we need to, I think you know about that.
I'd like to know what's happening now. I remember about 10 years ago hearing a lot about that, and I myself was boycotting Nestle and all the various companies associated with Nestle, but I haven't heard the information on it in quite a while now. I mean, if they backed off from that, or what's happening?
The boycott was successful. It doesn't mean that Nestle isn't going to try something else, but the infant formula boycott did succeed.
In what way?
So what happened?
Are you familiar with the boycott?
Yes.
That they no longer ship the infant formula.
Is that right?
To
nor promote
so
it.
Nobody's...
They don't promote it.
Yeah, change their marketing.
So nobody's down there promoting it. They're all back to breastfeeding.
I don't know. I haven't done a survey, but I, you know.
Basically,
Nestle's is still down there promoting other stuff, like coconut milk, which is ridiculous because, you know, you practically trip over coconuts while you walk down the sidewalk. So they're still, you know, trying to make parents feel that they're not good parents unless they buy powdered Nestle products. But at least it's not competing with the breastfeeding.
They're still monitoring it, but like the InFact office in Minneapolis was closed, and a lot of the people have now gone to work in other boycotts, most dramatically against GE for nuclear war. But it really was successful, and it was really a long, hard struggle. And you can really see, although it isn't a dramatic thing that in fact was, because, you know, that was affecting, you know, the actual health of babies so dramatically. But you can see the same kind of deceptive marketing in what they're doing now. I mean, Nestle's just had the little stores plastered with ads, you know, to take chocolate powdered milk and to take powdered coconut milk and all sorts of these things. And those are high profit items, and the people have very little money. And so when they spend their money on that sort of thing, it's a problem. But it isn't, you know, what in fact was pointed at is, as you know, was at the encouraging the breastfeeding and getting rid of the infant formula. And it declared that it was successful and achieved the objectives.
Can we buy those spoons in the drugstore here?
I can't find them.
Isn't that amazing?
I can't find them.
You can buy a package for like $4 or $5. It's called Gastrolite.
Astrolite?
Gastrolite. Gastrolite. Some drugstores have it and some don't.
So what is this measure? What is it, 3/4 of a... Or a spoonful?
I'm not sure. I've never compared exactly.
If we found out exactly, then we can make our
own. Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you want to go up to the kitchen and check it out, yeah, you bet.
The only kicker in the third world is to make sure the water's clean. You know, if the water's dirty and has some more, you know, the bacteria or the diarrheal causing agents in it, you can have a problem again.
Do you have some things that you would like to share, or questions or comments, things that you know about in regards to this that might inform the rest of us?
Maybe we'll watch that video. Yeah. It's about the video is not the highest caliber. I got it from my brother, and it was a copy of a copy. It was on 2020, and Hugh Downs is the one who moderates it. So I think it's good enough so we can get something out of it, but it's just not the best. I don't know. I think that's the difference in just, you know, the simple solution and the Gastrolite. I suppose it makes it a little better in the baking, but I don't know. I don't know the technology or have the medical background.
I think calcium is really an important electrolyte and transfusion, diffusion of anything into a cell and out. So that they're probably just refining the formula and packaging it. Otherwise, I have a feeling that does the job.
Are you a doctor?
Well, I'm in the health sciences. I'm in the dental area. Oh. But I'm sure that would do it as well. Potassium is there probably to facilitate the uptake of the fluid. I don't know why baking soda.
But the... you know, the neat thing about it is, like, you know, the three-fingered pinch and a handful of sugar or a little spoon like that, you know, that's all you need. Just have one of those in the drawer, you know, or in the house. And, you know, cholera just, and those things just kill thousands. To think of all those people with no education in Bangladesh. And did you hear them? They made the same comment about the birth rates and the death rates here. Remember, we had a big debate about that 2 days ago, and, you know, people, there's a lot of resistance to that, you know, the thought that you have to have stringent population control and cut down the population before you can start solving hunger and getting people to survive. And it's just the other way around. There is the connection there, it's just the other way around.
Do we have infant deaths because of diarrhea, and what sort of number in the United States?
Glad you asked. There's Bread for the World. Is their present campaign is called WIC, and it's right up there, the Food for Life resolution. It's women, infants, and children. For women, infants, and children in the United States. Let's see. Not sure how many. It says at the moment WIC is serving like 3.3 million out of an estimated 8.4 million who need the benefits of WIC, and that includes the oral, it includes Gobi. It's just Gobi in the United States. I'm trying to get that to as many people as possible. pregnant women. It also means improving the diets of pregnant women, getting them decent food. And then these 4 points here. So if you're interested in, you know, writing congressman, there's the...
Do you know what the status of that is?
It's up right now, as far as I know. It's their, it's the Bread for the World direction for legislative action this year. And in fact, the Bread for the World legislative, you know, key to their program the last 2 years was the Child Survival Campaign. And they felt that that's on track so well in terms of additional U.S. appropriations that other people will pick it up. And so they have transferred their attention. I don't know.
Is it a committee or is it on the board?
Well, in this, what's the date of that one, honey? That newsletter? Is there one on it? You know, I've read something just in the last couple months urging support, and it's still got resolution numbers. The S is for the Senate and the H is for the House. And so, you know, until that actually becomes a bill and then becomes law, it won't be passed. And then even if it, as it becomes law, then they have to decide what the appropriation is. And of course, the amount of the appropriation has a tremendous effect on its impact on people. So both of these are real important things for people to be involved in right now. We've sort of talked about involvement a little before, and we'd like to talk about it more. One thing, just to finish off talking about Gobi, is on the next page of this little pamphlet, it kind of says some of the things that have been done in three different countries in different places around the world, which is real interesting. The marketing of this thing, you know, to make people aware has been real important. And it kind of tells how they did it in Brazil, Burkina Faso, and India. And so it's real exciting to, you know, see those positive things. I mean, we see so many problems, and to see, you know, real advances and real potential and places where you can really do something. And then the last page talks about ways you can participate, in particular writing letters and supporting organizations and education and you know, all those sorts of things we've talked about. And we've written down here also this other address Ricky's written up here. That's UNICEF, and they're really the head of the Child Survival Revolution, and they're is their central office. Like, I know in Minneapolis we have a Child Survival Committee for Minneapolis, which is doing education in the community and things like that, and generating grassroots support for, you know, larger appropriations and things like that. So if you want to find out where the closest committee to your home is, you could write to them. Or you know, if you want some support in you know, having some an organization, forming an organization in your church or your committee or something, you could write to them and find out, because they need to have that appropriation every year. It's incredible. You get those dollars. Immunization is the one we haven't talked about, and it says right in here what some of the diseases are that they are immunizing against. Measles, whooping cough, tetanus, polio, and tuberculosis and diphtheria. I mean, look at those. I mean, our kids get them in one shot, all of those things, in a booster. And bang, I think they get a series of them. And then I think when they get the one when they're, what, 6 or 7 or something, and they don't need another one until they're 15 years old. Yeah, in doing this work back in Minneapolis, the Rotary Clubs contributed some money to help us buy books to go in the schools. And the and I always thought of Rotary as sort of kind of a good old boys organization or something like that. And they do some tremendous things. Rotary is an international organization. And, you know, they do things all over the world. And one of the things they've really gotten involved in is an immunization program. And they determined that it was, you know, really tragic to have these common diseases, you know, widespread around the world when they could really get handled by immunization. So internationally, Rotary decided to eliminate polio. And so they made that decision, and they named their program something like, I think it was Polio 2000, to eliminate polio by the year 2000. And they set a target of $120 million to do it. And as they started doing more research and started doing the fundraising, they realized that they will eliminate polio totally from the planet for much less than $120 million. So they had to rename their project, and now it's called Polio Plus. And now they're not only targeted polio, but many other diseases. And they're going to work in conjunction with the child survival, because they, you know, it's getting out and doing the immunizations and bringing the people in that's real important. But you can see some of the tremendous advances that have been made. Egypt was saying, it was real exciting. I was just, you know, reviewing some of this stuff to come down here. They said by the end of July 1987, they were targeting to have every child in Egypt immunized. And I thought, end of July 1987. Hey, that's today. So, you know, those things are really happening. And, you know, 20 million people vaccinated in Brazil in the last 3 years. And so there really are some tremendous advances in these areas. So there's really cause for real hope. And so we wanted to kind of come back full cycle. You know, we've talked about everybody making a difference and your own action making a difference. And, you know, this is one of the many, many ways that people can participate in making a difference.
You know, I think we've kind of talked about that, you know, about how we make a difference before. And I would really like to, we have more things on the agenda here that we could talk about, but I think it might be a real nice opportunity for people to share with one another what they're doing or what they might like to do. And maybe we can kind of support one another, even if what you're doing seems small to you.
Or if what you're doing is an idea of what you might want to be doing, or, you know, things you've run up in next to at home that have made it seem like, well, it's impossible, you know, to really do something. Like you were sharing with me this morning about your church, because it seemed, you know, kind of, there was a lot of inertia in the church.
Yeah, you mean about the hunger?
Bread for the World and the...
Oh, okay.
And the hunger dinner.
Yeah, I've been a part of two congregations, both that have been kind of conservative and need a little bit of a push to get beyond the charity. I think churches are pretty responsive to hunger, right in the area especially. Mm-hmm. And given an opportunity, I have seen people be extremely generous with, whether it's a Hungry Sunday, the first Sunday of the month, or that this is your month for Lutheran Social Services or whatever. But to cause them to look beyond that and to go to the causes of hunger and to think in terms of being a political force, it is kind of a step further. And so we're hoping that we can get Bread for the World on our budget for next year as a covenant congregation. Some of us are members individually, but if we can do that as a church, and hope that through the board that would be sponsoring that there would be some ownership of that it's not just something that's thrust upon us, but that there is an awareness of what we're doing, and that we can, in legislating different kinds of acts, we can either negate or we can enhance all of this charity that we're doing, where one act of Congress, one bill that's passed, can mobilize just an immense amount of food, like WIC or FEMA or any of these. And I worked with LSS, where we could get thousands and thousands of dollars worth of, some of it's excess food, but some, you know, commodities, and some of it's just good, solid food for the people of our communities and so on. So it's really important to be political, and this is what we're trying to do in our congregation, and yet to us it doesn't seem to be that controversial. Bread for the World is not controversial. They go a real fine line there, making issues known, and Bread for the World does have a lot of materials. They have a video, they have, one of the things they do is a little pamphlet. I think it's up there somewhere. What Else Can You Do About Hunger? And it's written toward the American Lutheran in this particular, ours is an AMC church, and it has all quotes on that.
Thanks.
Well, I know down in Peru, the measles is running rampant, and that so often goes into encephalitis, which is very, very serious. And our daughter goes down there. She's a doctor at Johns Hopkins, and they send a team down there every year to help with the children who have measles. And they do research on how to combat the measles. And also, they found out that people with multiple sclerosis have a background of measles in their childhood, severe cases of measles when they were children. So it's far-reaching.
Do you know if they're using these kinds of methods there? Or it'd be interesting to...
I don't know what methods they use. Yeah. It's the university that sponsors it.
Mm-hmm. You know, Doris, my oldest son, it was real strange when he was about 4 years old. He got a little sick, and he had red dots on him. And... you know, the doctors looked at him and they were starting to say, you know, they couldn't figure out what it was. And I had measles when I was a kid, and I said, well, it looks like measles. Well, we don't really think it can be. And they sent him to another doctor, and they went all around in circles for the longest time. And finally they said, yep, he has measles. And he wasn't that sick or anything, he was well, but they hadn't seen measles for so many years, you know, that they didn't really know what it was anymore.
Well, that's why Johns Hopkins has to go down to Peru to do their research, because they don't find any measles.
Nobody's got measles.
Measle problems here.
We all had measles when we were kids.
I had, I know.
The only thing they have anymore is seems to be chicken pox. The one.
There was an outbreak in Montana this year. Measles.
What's there?
And they were real strong. I mean, if anyone under the age of like 30 was encouraged to go in to make sure that their immunization was strong enough or whatever, that it would work. And all over the campus of the University of Montana, they had to spend those signs up doing immunizing.
You know, this would be a good place for a little anecdote, you know, when we think about some of these diseases. And then we'd like to hear from more of you. How many minutes? Okay. That, you know, like ending a disease, you think of it, smallpox ended all over the planet in 1970s. It had ended long before then in the United States. And there's a campaign cost $100 million to do it. And the United States contributed 50 of that $100 million. Even though smallpox wasn't still a problem here. By investing the $50 million to end smallpox, the U.S., it's now estimated, saves $100 million annually in money that it would have spent on immunization, quarantine facilities, vaccination, surveillance, and so on. So by even though it wasn't in this country, by kicking in our $50 million back then, we now save, on a continuing basis, $100 million too. So, I mean, it is really economical to help others, beyond, you know, a calling from our beliefs.
Any other concerns that you'd like to bring up?
I can mention something. I just read the newspaper, and it may affect some of the families in the United States. The program where they give dairy products to the poor has virtually ended now, because there are no more supplies in this huge backlog and all the caves and everything. And the reason is that the prices have dropped on certain dairy products to the point now where they have slaughtered cows and other things, so that the supply and demand are meeting, and that may have some sort of impact on the welfare of some people.
So that the cheese and the butter distribution is ending?
That's virtually nearly ended right now. I just happened, just a minute before I came in here, I had to read that, which I wasn't aware of.
Yeah, a lot of people rely on that.
Related to that, can I share about the project? It's in one of those Seeds magazine, or do you have those with you today?
Mm-hmm. Magazine.
You all know Heifer Project International? It's an interfaith group also that has been involved in sending heifers or rabbits or chickens or other healthy animals to the third world countries. And either interbreeding or providing food or rabbit pelts or whatever to help the economy. And there is a project right now that is of a very timely concern, and that is Save the Cows. We were talking about the slaughtering of the dairy cattle in our country. They're trying to save as many of those as possible and ship them. And these are the Holstein top producers. And it's timely because they're sending out the last shipment in August. So it needs to be done now before all of those herds are slaughtered. And it's just, you know, I'm from a farm background, and it just kills me that those cattle are being slaughtered for hamburger when they were bred to produce gallons and gallons of milk, and just being slaughtered. So there should be an address there somewhere.
Mary, you were expressing an interest in teaching, incorporating this in some of your classwork. Would you share about that and what some of your ideas are?
I teach in a public school in California, and I was real interested in the curriculum materials that you brought, which are K through 12. And I'm real anxious to take that material back to my school and get something going as far as hunger awareness. I think a lot of this starts with education and awareness. And I can see, I'm not involved in the Hunger Project in California, Bread for the World, but I can see that I can start where I'm at in the students that I reach, that I work with, and then expanding that into the school perhaps. And also just, I kind of like to talk about what we can do in our own lifestyle as far as food. You know, attitudes about food and just consumption, and maybe a little bit about some of that, when we talked about the Nestle Corporation and some of these companies that are exploiting the third world countries. I'm kind of interested in some information on that.
Just in terms, were you at the Add Justice to Your Shopping Cart session? We kind of talked about that. I don't know if we got into things that you can actually do. One, I can just throw out some ideas, is to buy organic produce. One simple one is drink water as opposed to pop. Ask the people at your supermarkets where their produce comes from. You know, to figure out, you know, are people being exploited by, you know, where is this food coming from? Ask for organic. That's how yogurt and granola got popular. People kept asking for it. It grew. So those are just a few little suggestions.
Another good one is eat seasonally. In other words, if you're eating the sorts of things that are naturally growing now, you're going to be eating crops that will be coming more naturally from your own community and close by. Whereas if you're eating things that are totally out of season, you know that they're coming from distant places. And then that might be all right, but you may want to investigate that, because oftentimes when it's coming from other countries, the reason they're able to do that is the workers in those other countries aren't being paid fair wages. They're being taken advantage of. That's how they can afford to go all through those shipping costs and bring it up and still be competitive, because someone probably had their land taken away from them in the first instance and now is receiving a very low wage.
We have a few more ideas. Does anybody else have some that they might like to suggest?
I'm from Canada, and of course, so when winter comes, we're not going to produce much around there. So it has to be imported. Most of it is imported from either Florida or California in the south. And so that and so on. I don't know of any other way we would get such things as that.
That's true.
So it's out of season maybe for us, but nevertheless we have to have it.
Sure.
I was going to say something else. I think it was the Washington Post that I was looking at over there. It talks about a percent of your gross national product that a country gives for foreign aid. And I wonder if you looked at that. There are some countries that are at about 1%. It's about, they are really doing very, very well. The United States is at, that's more than 0.23%.
0.23%? 0.2%?
And Canada was hopeful to go toward 1%, and is at 0.48%. And has plans to go to 6% and 7%, you know, with, in the next few years. But anyway, I was wondering how you people here feel about that. But there's such a heated up economy, things going very well right now, that the United States is still at 0.23%.
Well, we have a whole session to do on foreign aid, and so it's a long thing. And if you'd like to look at some of that I have in this book here, it's really pretty interesting.